Hey, happy Monday. Welcome to Jay's Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. An interesting series in Minnesota. A lot of Blue Jays fans there, it looked like. Julia, sometimes I feel like 2 out of 3 is 2 out of 3.
Yep.
Winning 2 out of 3 when you win the Sunday game versus winning 2 out of 3 when you lose the Sunday game is a very different feeling on Monday.
It feels different. It's kind of hard to make sense of it in any other way other than it's just a psychological aspect of human life, I guess, and human fandom. But yeah, it does feel different. You had Chris LaRue yesterday, even me and Sho kind of making the point post-game that you kind of need to forget about the way that the series ended and really focus on the fact that you've won 4 series in a row against a good team, against a team that, you know, you're trying to make up some ground against in the wild card race. There's another tough series starting immediately today. So, yeah, just flush the loss, take the positives, kind of just move on to the next one. By the way, I've missed you.
Yeah, it was only one day. People were acting like I was off for weeks and weeks. Yeah. I missed one show.
I
missed you too.
It felt like longer than that. You know?
We were texting the whole time too.
Well, pardon me then for missing my co-host. You're lucky that I didn't just like bear hug you immediately when I saw you this morning.
That would have been
That's what
welcome.
I wanted to do.
Yeah. Should have done it.
Well,
should
now I know it. For next time. If you ever take another day off, I know that I can.
Yes. By the way, I am more mosquito bite than man today. I helped a friend open his cabin up north for the weekend, and it's great. It's nice. There's like a wood-burning sauna right on the lake. The beer was cold.
That
it was great. But at first I thought, oh, the bugs aren't that bad for a first weekend in June. And then I mowed the lawn. And I like disrupted all their homes, I guess.
Took revenge. Yeah,
I am one giant mosquito. You can't really tell on my arms because my arms are lots of colors already.
Right on.
But my legs are just. it looks like I have chicken pox.
I'm so sorry to hear that. It is, you know, kind of comes with the job a little bit if that's what you're up for over the weekend. But it is no fun. So if you seem distracted today, I'm sure that has something to do with
it. Yes, I'm
well.
Just scratching ruthlessly beneath the desk. Okay, so you said it. The Jays, this is it's a pretty good series win, regardless of the thing of the loss on Sunday. And it's always a little difficult to, you had the chance to sweep. You could have been one up on the Twins instead of tied with the Twins. But you went into the ballpark of a team that you are competing with for a wild card spot right now, and you took 2 of 3. You won a series. In entering the series, if we had said they won 2 of 3, you'd be very, very happy with that. The way things stand this morning, Tampa Bay, Toronto, and Minnesota are all tied at exactly 35 and 30 for the 3 wild card spots. So, you know, obviously this early in the season, you're still keeping an eye on the division, and you don't hate that the Yankees dropped 2 of 3 to the Red Sox, including an interesting one on Sunday Night Baseball. Those two bullpens are just, they're not great.
Yeah, and then you have the Blue Jays, right? Obviously, they have their shortcomings of their own here, but one thing you can rely on, and one thing that they could rely on this weekend, is the bullpen, starting with the bullpen day all the way to the end here.
Yeah, the bullpen day, once again, effective, and it's interesting. We'll talk about Bowden Francis' start on Sunday, but when you contrast Bowden Francis' start days to bullpen days, there's an interesting clash there. But they win 6-4 on Friday. They went 5-4 on Saturday, and they lose 6-3 on Sunday. And in those two wins, something that a good bullpen lets you do, and we generally think of bullpen as you hold a lead. Come in, guy gets a hold, guy gets a save, 7, 8, 9, boom. Having a really strong bullpen that you can rely on, though, and the Blue Jays are top 5 in bullpen ERA in the league right now. And that's with Jimmy Garcia on the IL. We haven't seen Eric Swanson his best. Nick Sandlin's been gone a long time. No Ryan Burr yet. There's a lot. There are more bodies coming for the bullpen eventually, and they're still a top 5 bullpen ERA. In addition to holding on to leads, they also keep the game close. And early in the season when the Jays couldn't hit, that felt like nothing, right? It's like, oh, great. Okay, Yariel and Jimmy Garcia and Brandon Little kept the game 3-1, and the Jays had no chance of coming back.
Yep.
But now that the bats for the last 6 weeks or so have been a little juicier, the bullpen keeping those games within range, keeping those games manageable, is huge. And it's a big part of, yes, the offense being better is how you get a comeback win. You can't do a comeback win without the offense getting some runs across. But the Blue Jays have 19 comeback wins on the season now. And the bullpen being as good as they were Friday and Saturday is a big part of that. You keep things within range. You keep things in striking distance. And you buy your bats time to come around.
Yeah, and that's and when the bats are swinging the way that they are, that is when you start to see the benefit of that bullpen, 100%. The Blue Jays had 24 comeback wins all of last season. And
I believe only the White Sox, who set a record for fewest overall wins in the league, I believe only they had fewer.
Yeah, listen, we spoke to Mitch Bannon on Friday, and one thing that he pointed out between the Blue Jays of last season and the Blue Jays of this season, around this time, the biggest difference in numbers is actually the bullpen. It's the fact that these guys are coming in and keeping the game where it is. And then when the bats get going, power fixes a lot of things. It really, really does. And when you have a George Springer who's homering in back-to-back games to help you with that, again, when you have an Alejandro Kirk who's coming in and he is still giving you the quality of bats when you need him with runners in scoring position and all of that, that is the difference, right? That is truly the difference. And I know that the Blue Jays starters up to this point have been kind of okay most of the time. If you look at the season as a whole, it's been a lot of okay for Blue Jays starters, but that's okay right now. That's fine, especially if the bats continue to swing the way that they have. And the one game this series where they didn't hit a home run, they didn't hit for power, was yesterday, and then it became insurmountable late. You have to point out it's kind of, we're talking about the bullpen here. Yesterday was kind of a weird one where Mason Fluharty sort of ran into a bit of trouble, and then Eric Swanson could do nothing to help him. Fluharty ends up getting a couple of earned runs to his name that maybe shouldn't have been there. I don't know. You can kind of look at that in different ways. We're still waiting for Eric Swanson to look like Eric Swanson. His velocity is still down. There's question marks there, but I'm willing to sort of take it with a grain of salt because he's just come back. But yeah, it was kind of we saw exactly what is going right for the Blue Jays in the first two games. And then that last game was just Bowden Francis got hit around again. The bullpen could not necessarily keep the game where it was. And that was a combination of factors. And there was very little power to the bats.
Yeah.
So there we are.
Very little power. Two doubles. And yeah, you can nitpick the runners in scoring position hitting, but 2-for-7, that tells me that you didn't get guys. You didn't have enough traffic. And you're going to need a home run to bring those guys across. So yeah, it was... it's an interesting situation the way you lay out the starting pitching, because the Blue Jays have played, this is probably the best 2-week stretch they've had since 2023,
right?
Maybe even 2022, depending on how you feel about a 9-2 stretch versus a 9-1 stretch, whatever. They certainly didn't play 2 weeks of ball this good last year. Mm-hmm. And if they did in 2023, it was okay. And it was very starting pitching reliant. I think you could take some comfort in the fact that they have been able to do this 9-2 stretch, without great starting pitching. Kevin Gausman has been okay in his two times through. Jose Berríos has been very good in his two times through. But Chris Bassitt has not been. He's kind of been pretty tough on himself coming out of those last, even though I believe they won both of the games. And then there have been a couple bullpen days, and there have been a couple Bowden Francis days, which have turned into pseudo bullpen days. So the fact that you are playing very good ball, results-wise and offense-wise and bullpen-wise, while not getting quite the starting pitching that you are accustomed to, because for years and years we've been spoiled with four starters generally who are going to start 30 games and have an ERA right around 4, it's pretty encouraging. Now, I have said earlier in the year and over the last couple of years that to buy that a team is meaningful come playoff time,
right,
kind of have to have a stretch where for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you seem like the best team in baseball. It's not universal, but you go back and you look at every team that's made the World Series over the last couple of years, there was a 2-3 week stretch sometime in the season where it felt like everything was clicking and you just couldn't beat them. I don't think the Blue Jays are quite there yet. The Mets, the Tigers, the Rays are also like hot-ish right now, and the Blue Jays record still does have the 4 against the Athletics. However, you're about to play at St. Louis, at Philly, two more teams that are pretty St. Louis is out of a wild card spot right now, but they're in the mix. They want to be in the wild card they're one game back because the NL is so bad. They're 7 games over 500, though. It feels unfair. You're about to go into St. Louis and into Philly. You can take 4 of these. I'm going to feel pretty good about that part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Now, to do that, you're going to need good starting pitching, but...
Huge test coming up. And I know that we've been saying that a lot about this team. We said it in Philly. We said it against the Phillies here. We said it in Minnesota. And we're going to keep saying it. This is a big road trip for the Blue Jays. I think that, the first test has been passed, I would say. But you and I have spoken so much about creating momentum, creating sort of a rhythm for yourself in which you're winning these ball games. And one thing that I've said is that you can't be your own momentum killer. And right now it feels like with a bullpen day, and you know, the Blue Jays did a good job maneuvering that and separating Bowden Francis to in the bullpen day, but that this is still a stretch that is always, or that is going to be a problem until there are questions, there are answers to these questions. Right now, Spencer Turnbull was activated. We'll see what he can do. John Schneider was pretty, you know, pretty specific yesterday in saying that he doesn't really think that they need to talk about Bowden Francis's spot right now in that rotation. And so we are going to see Bowden Francis face off against the Phillies again. We all saw how that went the first time. I don't know. There are certain things right now that I think are self-inflicted and that are preventing the Blue Jays from maybe going on a stretch like you mentioned, where they just look like the best team in baseball.
Yeah, and the self-inflicted part is hard because Bowden Francis hasn't been particularly strong, and I do think if they had more rotation depth ready to go, he probably would have been figuring this out at Buffalo right now. Now, Chris Bassitt had a really interesting quote to Shai Davidi in a piece for Sportsnet.ca last night that kind of pushed back on that, and you know, Bassett's coming at this from a what is best for the pitcher and what is going to get the pitcher where he needs to be the quickest. So I understand that aspect of it. And this is the quote from Bassitt: sending a guy down and moving a guy, I believe he means to the bullpen, because they're struggling, that's not how you develop someone into being a good big leaguer. It's just not. What drives me crazy is the so-called protecting a guy. Then he goes in to talk about if you remove a guy after 50 pitches because he's struggling, he's still got 50 pitches left. You should leave him in there and let him pitch through it and figure it out. So he gives this very interesting insight into what it's like to be struggling and need to figure it out. And he very, very much seems to think that Bowden Francis can continue figuring this out at the major league level. Says, we're grown men. We could take the so-called punches on the chin. Go figure it out. And I really appreciate Bassitt laying that out. It's similar to when I talked about Bowden Francis between starts and he said Kevin Gausman, and kind of grabbed him and, you know, reminded him that everyone in that room except for Max Scherzer has had peaks and valleys. Kevin Gausman was designated for assignment and moved to a bullpen at one time. Chris Bassett's had bad stretches of starts where I think at one point last year, Bassett was leading the league in home runs given up, and now Bowden is, and look at where Bassett is since that time. So it's interesting perspective. I will say the Blue Jays are in a spot competitively where every win and every inning matters. So I think if they had other options, that would be a conversation that's been had already.
Yeah.
John Schneider kind of said also that they're not even exploring things necessarily like an opener or something like that yet, because they already have one spot in the rotation. They're doing that for with the bullpen days. I will say, given that I'm an anti-opener guy, like I know that gets painted as like an analytics thing. I don't like it. I think it's disruptive to a starter's routine. I think the risk is so high if the opener struggles, then you also lose the benefit. It's and like a lot of teams will use a bad reliever when the opener was designed for it to be a very good reliever in that spot.
Absolutely.
You know, when the Rays first started, I'm drawing a blank on who it is they used all the time, but they used the same guy all the time initially. It's like, well, you have one. It's like using your eighth inning guy in the first inning because it's the top of the order. So I don't really like it. I will say, given how the Phillies' top of the order looks and Francis's struggles with left-handed hitters in particular, that is one spot where I would consider it on the weekend if Francis starts. Like maybe opening with Mason Fluharty to get through the first four hitters, then you go to Bowden Francis, and then so if Bowden Francis is only going to go twice through the order, or not even twice through the order, like it's Schwarber and Harper that he avoids the extra time through. And if he's rolling, maybe you do give him a third time because it's the bottom of the order that he's seeing. So that would be interesting. And then you have Eric Lauer ready or whatever. The actual answer to all this is probably it depends how it goes Wednesday. They do have off days Thursday and Monday as well, so they could juggle a little bit as necessary. But yeah, it's all a big question mark. The other big question mark in sorting this out is we have no idea what Spencer Turnbull is going to look like.
We have no idea what he's going to look like.
I have an idea of what he looked like in his last AAA start because I watched it this morning.
Oh, yeah?
It didn't look very good.
command issues, I'm assuming.
Yes.
A lot of walks.
Yes, and John Schneider has talked about him dealing with some mechanical things that were, you know, John Schneider's favorite word this season, weird.
Weird.
So word Spencer
that's been
Turnbull
used a lot around this guy. Honestly.
For anyone who doesn't know, Spencer Turnbull was added to the roster yesterday because his 35 days are up. So when you sign someone to a major league contract and the season's already started, you can send them on an optional assignment, but you only got 35 days. You can't at that point. You have to add them to the roster, and then you know. Chips fall where they may. I saw, you know, people making the jokes, get ready for your one appearance before getting designated for assignment. I don't think it'll be that extreme. But at no point in his ramp up, other than his first outing at A-ball, did Spencer Turnbull look like a guy who was quite ready, which you understand. He hasn't pitched since late last year due to a lat issue and then not being signed with the team for spring training. So I don't think this is going to fix everything.
Right. We definitely should not have that expectation. Now, Turnbull found kind of unexpected success last year with the Phillies before he went down. So you kind of do still have that to sort of look at and try to emulate in any way, shape, or form. It's just tough to believe that he's going to go back to that when we know how things are going in his rehab outings, right?
Yeah, and he's had a weird career anyway where, like, he wasn't good at first. Then he was awesome in the pandemic-shortened season.
Right.
And then he was really good to start the next season, then got hurt, and then didn't pitch in 2022. 2023, he was awful, but he was just coming back from injury. And then, like you said, last year kind of found money for the Phillies in a Ross Stripling-type swingman role. So I don't know what to expect, but the velocity has not been good. The command has not been good. I would imagine Wednesday's plan still involves a lot of Eric Lauer,
right.
Whether Turnbull gets a time through the order or they do a pseudo opener or something like that. Like, I mean, Paxton Schultz got optioned down, but Braden Fisher has gotten that assignment once or whatever. I'd imagine Eric Lauer is still the primary, we'll call him, for Wednesday.
Yeah.
Maybe they just use Turnbull as a reliever in the interim. I'm not really sure what to expect.
Maybe if you want to continue to build a guy up, maybe that is the way to do it. Just give him shorter spurts in the majors and see what he can do. I don't know. It's there are no good answers right now to what the Blue Jays need to do with that rotation spot, to be honest. And just to go back to Chris Bassett's comments and Bowden as well. I'm not a fan of, you know, comparing different pitchers and what they may or may not be going through, but this era of Blue Jays baseball and this era of Blue Jays administration has come with some cautionary tales. And one thing that I go back to here is Alek Manoah's 2023 season. That got out of hand, right? In a way that you kind of saw flashes of the 2022 Manoah, but for the most part, it was command issues. It was maybe he was hitting some more batters than Ben Francis is right now, but it was ugly. And it continued to get uglier. And people were clamoring for perhaps optioning him to Triple A or skipping a start, giving him a chance to figure things out a little bit.
And then what happened?
One third of an inning, he gave up, I think it was 7 runs, whatever it was, against the Astros. And that was mid-June. That is when the Blue Jays option him to the Florida Complex League, if I'm not mistaken. He comes back. He still doesn't have it. A month later. He still doesn't have it. I think he finished the season with the Blue Jays.
He pitched until mid-August, and then there were all those weirdnesses about, like, he is technically been optioned. There was reporting that Manoah's side suggested he was hurt, and that's partially, you know, the IL time versus the minor league time and things like that. But he was effectively, I don't think they actually placed him on the developmental list once he got assigned, but he was effectively on the developmental list, which is go to the complex and work on your stuff. Like, it's the thing Arjun Namala did when he was struggling in Dunedin last year, before he burst out and turned it around. So, there was weirdness around the reporting of, you know, Manoah thinking maybe he was injured, the Jays disagreeing on the plan for him moving forward and things like that. But basically, so that is a case of, yes, you waited too long to make the hard decision.
Right.
There was also like a weird misalignment, it seems, between player and organization that at least they won't have that with Bowden
Francis.
Which
doesn't seem
to exist here.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is that was a young pitcher who was struggling, and the Blue Jays took way too long to make a tough decision, and it hurt their season, and it hurt the rest of their starters, right? So again, I can't believe that this is where we are a few years later, and we're still talking about starting pitching depth and the fact that they don't have enough of it, and they're going to ask too much of the same three guys who were, you know, there's just a lot there that is similar. It is not the same situation, and I don't want to make a one-for-one comparison. It's just that we have been here before, and these difficult decisions, they need to be made, and it's not just for the good of the player. It is also for the good of the team. You said it, Blake. Every game matters. Every inning matters. And this Bowden Francis' starts right now have become pseudo bullpen days. That's kind of where we are.
Yes. And it's they're 4-9 in his starts.
4-9 in his starts, which in the bullpen days, I know that they're doing better.
Yes. I can't remember the exact number, but they're significant. And I do think part of that is like you plan for a bullpen day, right? So the day before a bullpen day, you manage your bullpen a little differently with the back of your head. Better not use Eric Lauer here. We're going to need him 45 pitches tomorrow. You have a plan and you come into that knowing, whereas the Bowden Francis days are like now I think you're planning for best case scenario. He five and dives.
Yeah.
Like he gives you five, but it's been more like four and door or three and flea. I don't have one for
Stop
two.
It.
But yeah, I think that's where the bar needs to be for Bowden, at least the next couple of turns. It's like, if you can get him back to five.
Yeah.
I know like long-term he wants to be a 6-7 and he's a big guy. He thinks he can carry a big workload. Right now you got to get him back to five, two times through the order, because that would be a step in the right direction. Now, as to your point about, you know, waiting a little too long, like we kind of outlined, if there were options ready, this might look a little bit different. If there were not already a bullpen day in the rotation. So there's Eric Lauer, who's been solid. There is Spencer Turnbull, who is now back, and who knows, mystery box for the time being. There are a couple updates that are relevant to this conversation. This is way off, but just because you mentioned him. Yep. Alpino is going to face live hitters tomorrow for the first time in his ramp back up from internal brace procedure. So that's fun.
That's fun. He will save this team, I think. No, we don't want to put that kind of pressure
on him. I'm trying to sprinkle a few positives in here, and I'm going to build up from the lowest level of update to the highest level of update. So Alec Manoah is going to face live hitters for the first time in his rehab on Tuesday. This is absolutely not related to major leagues this year, but just as a note, Brandon Barriera, the team's 2022 first rounder, pitched in an FCL game on the weekend, his first time pitching in a very long time because of multiple injuries. He is also working his way back from a UCL procedure. So those guys very far off.
Yeah, it's encouraging news nonetheless.
Yes, it's when you look at the entire organization's pitching depth and the pitching depth for years moving forward, getting some of those guys. Landon Moraitis continues to rehab at the FCL level as well. So let's go up a step.
Yep.
Again, not related to major league interest right now, but as I was doing my updates this morning, Rafael Sanchez for the AA New Hampshire Fisher Cats, who were wearing chicken tender jerseys on the weekend, threw a no-hitter.
That is amazing.
He is never allowed a hit when he's wearing a chicken finger jersey.
That is amazing. He will not forget that.
No.
Huh? It'll be the answer to a trivia question one day. That is awesome. Yes. I'm so glad you included that in our updates. Please keep going.
Not related to the to the major league depth whatsoever. Now, here are the two that are actually relevant, and sorry to do the slow build. Max Scherzer faced live hitters yesterday in Florida. These updates come via Shai Davidi, by the way, and John Schneider talked about it a little bit post-game as well. But Max Scherzer threw a three-inning simulated game, got to 50 pitches. Dalton Varsho took him deep. So if you're wondering, Dalton Varsho is not running yet, but he is taking guys deep down
deep
at the complex.
For sure.
So three innings, 50-pitch sim game. Max Scherzer is now going to operate as if he's on turn. So he will throw a side session over the next couple days as if he were in the rotation, and then 5 days from now when his turn comes up, they have not determined yet if that'll be in an FCL or a single A or a triple A game or whatever. My sense is that they're going to be pretty aggressive with Max Scherzer, because if that thumb is a ticking time bomb, if you don't know how long it's going to be good before it flares back up again, and it's Max Scherzer, literally Max Scherzer, why have him do 3-4 starts at the A and triple A level if he feels like he's Max Scherzer and you think that thing's only going to last 30 innings, get those innings at the major league level.
And when you need those innings at the major league level as desperately as the Blue Jays do right now. Yeah, I agree with you. This should be, and listen, the timeline right now is looking a lot shorter than what we anticipated, frankly. I didn't expect to see him back until next month. But if this is how things are going, I think I agree with you. I think you need to sort of, you know, forget the conservativeness for a little bit and just bring Max Scherzer back. This is when they need him, honestly. And we don't know, right?
And he said 50 to 55 pitches is kind of the spot where it flares up on him. So if his recovery coming out of this feels good, you know, you want to get him in at least one game to make sure, you know, his feel and everything is there and it responds well again. But I don't think Max Scherzer is going to need, like, he's Max Scherzer. I don't think he's going to need 4 or 5 rehab starts hanging around the same pitch count necessarily. The other update, which is not imminently relevant, but could be relevant as soon as a couple weeks from now. Adam Macko.
That's my favorite.
Yes. Guest of the show last year, a terrific guest. He made his first appearance at AAA on the weekend. So he had made 5 complex league starts. He is coming back from a knee injury, not an arm injury. So the recovery has been a little quicker. In the offseason, I had Macko like 7th on the depth chart from a starting pitcher. Like Jake Bloss was probably ahead of him. But based on what we saw last year, I was ready to go with Adam Macko. He made a start at AAA yesterday, went 4 innings, didn't allow a hit, walked 3 guys. So the command's still a work in progress, but struck out 4, didn't allow a hit. Most importantly, got through 4 innings. Yeah. Really good to see. That is a guy who, if the Scherzer, Lauer, Turnbull, Francis mix does not stabilize, let's say 2 weeks from now, could absolutely see Adam Macko starting for this team.
Yeah, it sounds like he's pretty determined to force the Blue Jays' hand a little bit. And the Blue Jays' hand may be forced in more ways than one because, again, there's no guarantee that, adding Spencer Turnbull will stabilize this rotation. If Max Scherzer is back, then maybe that's a different conversation. But honestly, Macko hands in a couple more of these, then he will be firmly in the conversation once again. And the Blue Jays kind of need also just that positive pitching prospect story. It's been a while since we've gotten one of those from the team here. So yeah, very, very encouraging to see Adam Macko come back. We kind of forgot about him proverbially, you know, quote unquote, for a little bit because the injury comeback was still sort of ongoing here. But what a way to come back and put yourself on the radar again immediately.
Certainly. And if you are someone who scouts the stat line only, he did have a 4.63 ERA last year, but a lot of positive underlyings and a bit of a mid-season turnaround. Shai Davidi wrote a feature for sportsnet.ca and Adam Macko joined us on the show shortly after that about some changes in, you know, his process. They went from having him pitch every 6th day to every 5th day. Just kind of things moved in the right direction a lot over the course of his time at AA last year. Only made the 1 appearance at AAA at the end of the season. But again, I think he is fairly close. He is on the 40 man. He is 24 years old. He's never thrown like 200 innings, but he's been a starter for a little while now. I think he's in the mix, which is a lot of fun.
I think so too. And was he part of the Teoscar trade? It was Swanson and Adam Macko, wasn't it?
Yes.
So that would also be cool, you know, to sort of see the upside of that trade a little bit more come to fruition at the major league level. I know that we're still, you know, a ways away from that, but you look at that trade and the way that it shook up and the fact that you got Nerick Swanson, but you also got a prospect. Narratively, it would be nice to see that prospect succeed this year. That's all I'm saying.
Narratively, I would have loved to have 26 more home runs in 2023. But that's, you can, when you're an organization that has struggled to find and develop pitching prospects, it's, that is definitely a win. Couple quick, we're almost out of time for this segment. The only thing I'll note then, I guess, is David Schneider had 0 plate appearances this weekend.
Yeah.
There were also opportunities on Thursday against the Phillies for him to pinch hit against lefties, and they went with 2 other right-handed bats off the bench first and didn't pinch hit him for Class A, who is a switch hitter. Nice optimism about David Schneider when he first came back up. He had obviously been playing better at AAA, joined us on the show. Doesn't seem like he's very much in the team's plans as a day-to-day thing.
Yeah, right, it's kind of weird. I said yesterday, too, that it's strange to see a guy like Alan Roden, who was showered with praises during spring training, broke camp with the team, get the 26-man treatment sort of thing.
One start over the last 4 games that were against right-handed starters.
That part
I don't expect to see him against lefties, but one of the last 4 against righties.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that, you know, obviously we're not on the road trip, so it's hard for us to get any more information. But if this trend continues, that is absolutely something that I'm interested in asking John Schneider about because, you know, there's upside to these guys, and it's kind of interesting to see how they're being utilized right now. I can't really make sense of it for myself.
Yeah, it's a little it's interesting. You're trying to win games. Nathan Lucas has been good. Miles Straw has been solid, but it is optically, it's a little odd to have two, not even prospect-ish guys, because Roden's 25 and Schneider's 26, but it's been interesting, we'll say. Okay, also interesting, Sunday Night Baseball last night, the Red Sox took one off the Yankees, and normally when you're in the AL East, you want both of those teams to lose somehow. The Red Sox got off to a cold enough start that you'll take the Yankees losing to. The Red Sox have had such a rough start to the season that June Lee called them aneurysm-inducing. We are going to take a break. We'll talk to June Lee about the Red Sox on the other side. He also faced Adam Ottavino. He stepped into the box against a major league pitcher recently, which will be fun to talk to him about. Katie Wu is going to join us in the second hour to preview the Cardinals side of this series. And Canadian prospect and Dunedin Blue Jays player Sam Shaw is going to join us around 11:30 as well. He had a couple of two-hit games on the weekend as the Dunedin Blue Jays had a pretty good week down there. All that's coming. I should have taken this break earlier. Let's do it now as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkin Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. If you heard Ben Schulman on that ad read on the way in, he said, join us tonight at 7:30. The game is 7:45, so this is the most awkward game time where Ben and Chris will have like 15 minutes to fill off the top. It does mean I get to do a double dip on Blue Jay Central tonight.
Oh, really?
I'm on there twice tonight.
Wow.
So that'll be fun.
So an extra 15 minutes buy you a bit more work.
Which is exactly what I wanted. Little programming note, by the way. So I'll be doing Blue Jay. I'll be hopping into Blue Jay Central. It's Jamie and Arden doing it. Caleb Joseph on the call with Dan Schulman and Hazel May down in St. Louis for this one. So that should be a lot of fun. I was talking with Caleb about that after the Phillies finale at Keegan's book launch on Thursday. He's done a couple games before. I'm very excited to see hear how that goes, because Caleb is, obviously we're so spoiled here with Buck and Joe as well, but Caleb is, I love talking like pitch sequencing with him and stuff like that. So excited for that tonight. Also excited to be joined by June Lee. He is at I Am June Lee on YouTube. June, what's up, man? Terrific hair day. How you doing, man?
Thanks. How's it going? Good to see you.
Yeah, you too, man. How's everything been going? It's been a fun, as a fan of your work, it's been a fun transition to see you kind of go independent and have the YouTube channel and be doing kind of, you know, it seems like whatever you want to do and a little bit more creative and out there. How's it been for you so far?
It's very exciting. It's definitely a roller coaster because you're riding the waves of like making content on YouTube and trying to figure out like what the audience resonates with and what kind of overlaps with your own interests. So I'm trying to figure that out. I mean, we're 2 months in and I feel like we're off to a pretty good start given the circumstances. And, I think it's very exciting. Like for me, YouTube has always been my end game. And so to have an opportunity to do this and to have the kind of the safety net to make this kind of leap is very exciting for me.
So we're mostly going to talk to you about baseball and some of the videos you've done around baseball and your Red Sox fandom as well. But you did a recent YouTube that was how knockoff jerseys became better than real ones. And I'm going to expose myself here and snitch on myself. When I was in university, I had a little side hustle ordering those knockoff jerseys from overseas and then marking them up and selling them to friends and things like that. I was the king of DHgate, if you remember that website at all. My question, and those ones would come and they would not be the best quality. You would get, I remember one time a friend got a Marshawn Lynch Bills jersey and the nameplate came upside down. So we had to take it to a dry cleaner and get them to unstitch it and stitch That's it back amazing. On. But you did a recent breakdown about how knockoff jerseys are kind of not even on par with regular ones, but surpassing in some circle. How did we get here with the knockoff quality?
I think we're kind of at a range where some of the knockoff jerseys, especially the top end ones, are definitely better than what you're getting in the retail stores these days, whether it's like the Blue Jay Stadium store or MLB.com. And the reason we've gone there is because over the course of the last decade, Fanatics has taken over the entire industry. And the reason that's happened is because all of the leagues across all the major sports in the United States, Major League Baseball, the NBA, the NFL, the NHL, they've all kind of given Fanatics the power to become the distributor for the main merchandise. Now, everything on these team websites isn't necessarily made by Fanatics, but most of the jerseys, whether it's the kind of entry-level stuff, the stuff that most fans are getting are made by Fanatics. And while Fanatics has taken on the load of buying the Majestic facility, which is where Major League Baseball used to make authentic jerseys. They might be coming out of the same factory, but the quality is definitely not the same anymore. Heat press jerseys, a lot of fans you see online these days are complaining about the quality of the jerseys, whether it's the polyester getting thinner, numbers, labels falling off. You go on TikTok, you'll see people complaining all over the place. And as a result, this massive black market has kind of emerged, whether it's on TikTok or on DHgate, which is still going well and strong, Alibaba. You see kind of a range of things that come out of those places. Like, you'll see some kind of crappier jerseys, but some of the better stuff you see on eBay, on DHgate, on Alibaba are quite high quality, and you're starting to see kind of more and more people gravitate towards that as the price of the authentic kind of replica uniforms has gone up, but the quality has gone down over time. And that is kind of the result of Fanatics becoming a monopoly on this entire industry. I mean, they own Mitchell & Ness now too. And Mitchell & Ness, I think, used to be kind of the standard bearer for great replica jerseys. And now you go to the Mitchell & Ness kind of merchandise, and that stuff is heat pressed on too. So this is not just the entry level stuff. This is the stuff that used to be considered high quality also kind of starting to fall in quality as well.
Yeah, June, I got to say, I have been trying to go through the regular channels here. I've tried to stay honest. So I've been on a quest to find an Orlando Pride Marta jersey for a long time now. Can't find it, you know, via the regular channels, but maybe, just maybe, you're the guy to help me find one.
I would just go on the TikTok shop and see what comes up. You know, I don't endorse going out and getting stuff, but, you know, I think it's just kind of the state of fandom these days where, you know, people are getting shortchanged when it comes to sports teams. I think the experience of being a sports fan is just way more expensive now than it's ever been before. Or it's ticket prices, all the streaming services that have come out that kind of split up games across, different services. Like, it would be like if you were watching Andor and that was split across three different streaming services, and then you had to pay $9.99 a month just to watch the finale. Like, that's what it feels like to be a sports fan these days. And so it's not just, you know, it is a story about merchandise, but it's really a story about like how the experience of being a fan right now, whether it's in the United States or around the world, has really kind of degraded over the course of the last 5 to 10 years.
Late stage capitalism, baby. This is, yeah. Hey, we own everything, so the quality is going to go down. Price of the bricks going up. We're going to step on it a bunch of times. It's not great. All right, let's talk some baseball, June. Before we get into some Red Sox stuff, you stepped in, and this is one of your first YouTube features. Again, it's I Am June Lee over on YouTube. You stepped in the box against Adam Ottavino. You faced a Major League Baseball pitcher. Give us, I mean, the video's up there. It's a great 12 or 13 minutes. But for anyone who hasn't seen us yet, give us the kind of cliff notes. How was that? How'd you prep for it? Did you feel okay about how you did?
This is something I've wanted to do for a really long time because I feel like most people have been on a couch at some point and have seen a fastball go straight down the middle of the plate and seen a guy swing through and been like, damn, maybe I could do that. And so I decided to kind of put that to the test. And so I hit up Adam Ottavino, who's, you know, kind of been a great source and a great buddy of mine over the years in the baseball world. And as he was kind of prepping for the season, I wanted to try to step in against him. And so he was probably at like 90% building up to spring training. We shot this in January. And it was kind of an eye-opening experience. You know, I played baseball through the end of high school. I probably saw like a high 80s fastball a handful of times in high school. You know, I'm now 30 years old. I haven't played baseball competitively in almost probably a decade plus at this point. So I wanted to see like what it would actually be like to literally step off the couch and step in against a major league fastball. And the context for this too, of course, is that like Ottavino has a great sweeper. You know, it's one of those pitches that I think kind of ushered in this new analytics era of pitching. But you know, he's throwing like 90 to 92 miles per hour. This is like the lower end fastball in regards to velocity in today's game. And so kind of given that context, I want to step in there. And, you know, I won't spoil the video too much, but it was definitely one of those experiences where I think it kind of recontextualized my relationship as someone who has, you know, been on shows like Around the Horn, gives hot takes on the internet about sports. You know, we all get paid to do this to some degree. And it kind of gave me a little bit more empathy, I think, in regards to, okay, when I'm sitting here on my couch watching these games on TV, what am I actually talking about? What can I actually bring new to the table that, you know, maybe is a little bit more fair than just trying to, you know, spark a flame on the internet.
So you brought up two topics that kind of caught my eye. Let's put it like that. One, that Ottavino is a buddy, which is very important, I would say, in this situation. Because, two, like you said, yes, we are paid for our hot takes. And so, you know, I was like, I would be worried that this guy would try to work the inner half of the plate a little bit more than usual.
Oh, yeah. If I asked John Axford to do this, and Axford and I are buddies, like, he would absolutely brush me back first pitch.
Ottavino was more terrified than anything of hitting me. Like, we didn't sign any legal papers beforehand, you know, not that I, you know, if something happened, you know, not that I would do anything from a legal perspective, but, you know, I think it was just one of the situations where he really didn't want anything bad to happen. And I think he kind of talked about this after the whole experience, that I think he was trying to keep everything a little bit closer to the outer half of the plate to keep things safe. I mean, he acknowledges himself that he's not like Greg Maddux out there. Control. So, like, I don't think that, you know, I think he was always just a little bit concerned about, you know, one getting away from him.
Well, glad that all worked out. Ottavino, by the way, for anyone who doesn't know, appeared in 3 games for the Yankees earlier this year with an ERA of 0.00 before getting designated for assignment. Looked like the Yankees could have used an arm like that in the bullpen this weekend, as the Red Sox took 2 of 3, put up 10 on Saturday, put up 11 last night. June, I know you have not felt great about the Red Sox so far this year, given it's the Yankees, and I think like one of those teams could have 159 wins, the other could have zero, and beating them would still feel pretty good as a Red Sox fan. Does that change at all how you feel about where the Red Sox are right now?
I think that they still kind of have their backs against the wall, because you look at the kind of fundamentals of the team. Like, any team can win 2 out of 3 games on a given weekend. And this team is a talented team. I mean, Alex Bregman is obviously a big addition. Garrett Crochet is a guy who probably is in the Cy Young conversation so far this season. But the rest of that rotation, whether it's, you know, Lucas Giolito, they had a guy, Hunter Dobbins, who's rookie out there, you know, on the mound last night, you know, Richard Fitz, like, the rotation hasn't been particularly strong. Walker Buehler was kind of one of the bigger additions of the offseason for the Red Sox. That rotation, aside from Crochet, has been pretty abysmal, and they'll say it out loud. I mean, Buehler, Giolito, they've expressed their frustration in these post-game press conferences with the media. And so that by itself is not an encouraging sign. And when you kind of build it on top of the history of what the Red Sox have been over the course of the last few seasons, where it's a 500 team that kind of goes back and forth, and then they added all of this like all-star level talent between Bregman and Crochet. Bregman looked like an MVP before going on the injured list a few weeks back. It's not very encouraging. You know, there's been a lot of conversation around Rafael Devers and whether or not, you know, that whole situation has been a distraction for the team. Devers has hit great since he's come up. The bigger situation right now is how the Red Sox philosophically are handling developing their young players. They've tried to kind of jerk Christian Campbell around from second base to first base. And then, you know, he was training at first base to replace Tristan Casas, who went on the injury list and is out for the season. And went after training for a few weeks, you know, before games at first base, he's suddenly not playing first base at all in games anymore. And then, you know, they're calling him Marcelo Meyer, but then they're not really hitting him. And then Roman Anthony, you know, the top prospect in the major, you know, in the minor leagues, is hitting 500-foot grand slams, but he's also not coming up. And so there's kind of this, like, it feels a little bit of an incoherent philosophy right now, where if you go back kind of to the Red Sox of the 2000s, when they were kind of churning out these young prospects like Dustin Pedroia and Jacoby Ellsbury and eventually Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts, they didn't put all this pressure on these young guys to be immediately stars out of the gate. And I think some of that philosophy shift has come with kind of the analytics era, kind of trying to prioritize guys coming up younger and younger and maximizing their physical prime. But I think what has happened in Boston in particular is that they're kind of in between. And so they're not fully committed to going all in with kind of top end talent. And they're trying to kind of have it both ways. And as a result, you're putting all this pressure on guys like Christian Campbell and Marcelo Meyer and Roman Anthony to be the saviors of this team, especially given how bad they've been over the course of the last half decade or so. And when you put all that pressure on these young guys, you're not asking them to be role players in the way that you were asking guys like Dustin Pedroia or Jacoby Ellsbury or Xander Bogaerts and Mookie Betts when they were rookies to come up and be good. You're asking them to kind of be core contributors. And I think that kind of split philosophy is why this team is kind of in this like no man's land in Major League Baseball.
And it's clear that there is, you know, frustration. All that pressure is leading to frustration. When you see comments like Alex Cora's in which he's, you know, even pointing to himself as, well, if they're not getting better, then maybe I'm doing something wrong. And we're seeing little spats pregame between coaches and other teams, you know, starting pitchers or whatever. What does that tell you, I guess, about the level of frustration around this team and in the locker room as well?
I think that there's just a lack of communication right now, a lack of just like, I think, people being on the same page between the players, the coaches, and the front office. And this has been a trend for basically dating back to the Chaim Bloom's era, where there was always kind of a lack of kind of shared vision between Alex Cora and Chaim Bloom. And I feel the same thing happening right now where, you know, Cora wants to win. He was complaining for years under Chaim Bloom. Why aren't we going all in when we're kind of on a 500 team and we're kind of leaning on the board of being like a team that should be trying to tank for the highest draft pick possible or trying to go for the playoffs? And I feel the same thing happening now to some degree. I mean, one of the hallmarks of Alex Cora's earliest teams with the Boston Red Sox, this is in 2018, 2019, even in 2021, they were really good at the fundamentals, all the small stuff, the base running, the fielding. And these Red Sox teams coming up through the minor leagues right now, they're rushing guys up. You look at Christian Campbell right now at second base, he'll make some spectacular kind of acrobatic plays, and then he'll just mess up kind of the ground ball right to him because he doesn't have the footwork down. And so there's kind of this, there's conversations right now among some areas of the Red Sox organization about whether or not this team is doing a good enough job at developing the fundamentals and putting kind of an emphasis on that in the minor leagues. And when Alex Cora gets them up to the major league level, you know, you got to have guys with a certain level of foundation to be able to kind of coach them up to a certain place. At the same time, like, Cora's been with this team for 6-7 years now, minus the whole suspension for the Astros sign-stealing thing. You know, he's kind of in an in-between place, too, where is this kind of the best situation for him moving forward? Is this a team that is going to be able to maximize his kind of managerial capacity, where he's been very good at managing the personalities in the clubhouse and making strong in-game decisions? There's kind of a lot of, you know, motivations I think maybe aren't aligned right now within the organization. And I think all of that tension is starting to come to a head.
Yeah, it's tough. It kind of reminds me of the Warriors when they had the 1 year where everyone was injured and they were like, we'll restock. Kuminga's in the door. Moses Moody's in the door. Pajemski the year after that. And they won a finals at the front end of that. But that was because Steph Curry and Draymond were still kind of at their peaks. And they have kind of struggled since then to manage those dual timelines. The Raptors ran into it a few years ago as well in a less extreme example. And the interesting part for the Red Sox is it's not a salary capped league and they're a big market. So it's kind of like a not small market way of operating, but it's not a big market way of operating to try to do the dual timelines at the same time. It's interesting, but you know, the thing you said the other day on Twitter about it, it's starting to get a little late fast. At least for 2025 here, I think they're 10th in the American League as of today. So it's I don't know. It's going to be it'll be interesting to see if they find a level of urgency between now and kind of the end of July.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Warriors example is kind of the perfect parallel to this across sports because, you know, they are trying to develop these young guys and bring on the next era of Red Sox baseball. But fans here are so impatient for, you know, sometimes good and bad reasons for this team to win. But, you know, Boston has a really, really high standard. And I think that there's still this residual, as crazy as it is, I think, from the Mookie Betts trade. Like, people are still, you know, even if they don't talk about it on a day-to-day basis, it kind of looms over everything. It's just a cloud over the entire organization because Mookie was such a representative of what the Red Sox used to be, the type of guy that the organization used to invest in. And that kind of snowballed into them bumbling up the Xander Bogart situation. And Xander hadn't necessarily been the best player for the San Diego Padres, you know, worth that contract. But, you know, those are the types of guys that the Red Sox historically have invested in and wanted to keep around long-term. And, you know, this kind of speaks to, I think, a larger trend happening in sports right now. I'm working on a YouTube video about this currently, where Fenway Sports Group, I think, is a preeminent example of, you know, this trend towards consolidation in sports, where we're having more and more owners across leagues spend a lot of money invested in Liverpool, which is a team that I also root for. Yeah, you know, they also have investment in the Pittsburgh Penguins. We're going to start seeing a lot more consolidation in sports ownership over the course of the next 2 decades. And there's a lot more emphasis now on not necessarily catering to your fans and your home market, but trying to grow these teams and really brands internationally. That's where all of the leagues across sports see the most growth potential to make the most money moving forward. And so, you know, we look at something like the English Premier League, for example. If you look at a team like Liverpool, obviously Liverpool is kind of a similar city to Boston in some ways in relation to London and the rest of the UK. But the majority of Liverpool fans aren't in Liverpool. They're around the world. And so that is the future that John Henry, but also the rest of sports ownerships across sports sees for American sports right now. They want American sports to grow globally for a whole variety of reasons, whether they're political or economic. That's where the focus is right now. And so these teams are trying to balance, you know, being able to still win. That's why, you know, John Henry smoked a cigar after they signed Alex Bregman this past offseason, while also having enough cash on hand to be able to invest in their other teams, to be able to grow the marketing, grow everything around the sport, especially in the next decade or two. I think is going to be kind of the heavy emphasis on American sports, especially as we kind of fully switch into this era of streaming being the primary way we watch sports.
It's fascinating to hear you lay that out. I'm a Jacksonville Jaguars fan, and they own Fulham and a wrestling company and stuff like that. And they're kind of, you know, the Jacksonville Jaguars, yeah, it's nice to have guys in Jacksonville, like fans in Jacksonville, but it's much more about, oh, we'll raise our hand, we'll do the two games in Europe every year because that's our only pathway to having a fan base as a relatively new NFL team with no history and not a huge market and things like that. So fascinating to hear. The other potential thing we can have is we can have more really bad digital decals on fields and courts and things like that. Untapped source of revenue there. If you can put a little NBA Finals emoji on the court, I know you saw it. It was just awful, and I wanted to slide it in the show here somewhere, man. That was ugly stuff last night.
Yeah, I think it just kind of speaks to where sports is right now. I think that we've almost forgotten having a sense of like reverence towards sports because almost it's been so torn down. Like people have seen so much of how the meat gets made these days because of social media, because everyone is oversharing. I think that there's, you know, you go back to some of the like NBC broadcasts in the 1990s, you go listen to Bob Costas do these like beautifully written, like poetic, you know, monologues about the NBA season. That sense of reverence almost doesn't exist for sports anymore. And I think that like, when you live in a time that we live in right now where there's so many crazy things happening and sports is this escape, when it feels like so bare bones and you feel like fans are getting shortchanged and people are trying to squeeze fans out of every last dollar from streaming to jerseys to everything, it's hard to kind of put sports in that same kind of reverential lens that I think it has been, when we were growing up. I think even dating back to like the 1960s and before that, like sports was kind of this mythic thing, I think, in culture. And I think so much of social media and the way that like people have just generally overshared, which I think is like emblematic of so many other things in our society. But I think that we've kind of lost our sense of like spectacle and reverence and almost storytelling, because I think we've just forgotten that like sports is supposed to be fun. And like, I think that we've like, because of hot takes, because of, I think our general disposition towards sports these days of being a thing that like people fight over versus like something people connect over, like fighting, and you know, it's fun to have sports debates. Like we do this for a living. Like yeah. We wanted to get into this industry because it's fun to have arguments over sports. But when they become almost very personal and almost like antagonistic for no reason, like that's when it starts to just like kind of cheapen the entire experience. And I think that, you know, as kind of we live in a world where like so many of our experiences are fractured these days, and a lot of people don't really share, you know, the same cultural references because of the way that the internet and culture is now. Sports is one of those last things where, you know, people still connect over it because it happens in the real world. It's a current event. And everyone lives in the world, you know, like it's not a TV show where you're going off to a fake universe. Like it's happening in front of our faces. And I think that we're seeing more and more casual sports fans. But I think that there's almost this gap, not to go off on too much of a tangent, between the casual sports fan these days that's mostly following sports on social media versus people like us who are like in the weeds of it and know the history and all the stats and all that stuff. And I think that there needs to be a way to kind of bridge that gap, because I think there's more people who want to get into sports, but are finding it hard to have that barrier to entry because sports is such an intimidating place to kind of enter.
Yeah, it's really well said. And we're coming up here on the anniversary of the Raptors winning the championship, and not to keep going cross sports, but I think back on that and the amount of people who were you know, casual who were able to become hardcore, because that became kind of, at least in Canada, like a monocultural event. Everyone was locked in on that. The Leafs were out. The Jays weren't interesting yet and weren't interesting at all that year. And like, that is a collective thing. It's a little harder to replicate, I guess, in the U.S. where one team doesn't represent the whole country. And like you said, as we continue to get more and more fractured, but it's an interesting reflection. June, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Really enjoying the foray into YouTube at I Am June Lee. Appreciate you taking the time, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Thanks for letting me ramble.
No, it's great, man. Love it. June Lee. Again, it's I Am June Lee is the YouTube page. Go watch him hit off Adam Ottavino, break down why your jerseys suck. not the ones you get at Jay's shop, but the ones you get elsewhere. Yes. A lot of great stuff from June. And yeah, a little, if you look at it, if you follow him on social media, you get a little Red Sox angst, which never hurt anyone.
No, I don't think so.
Never hurt anyone. Let's take a break. Let's tee up this Jays Cardinals series with Katie Wu of The Athletic. We'll also talk to Sam Shaw of the Dunedin Blue Jays and of Victoria, British Columbia, Canada in the second hour. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Jays won 2 of 3 on the weekend. They won 9 of their last 11. They'll try to keep it rolling in St. Louis this week. 7:45, 7:45, and 2:15 are your starts times. It gets going with Jose Berríos against Andre Pallante tonight. Very nice ballpark, by the way, in St. Louis. BNS drew the assignment, so he'll be down there.
Oh, good for him.
I haven't been there in like a decade, but it was nice.
Yeah.
It was a very good beer
garden.
Pretty
iconic for sure.
And a very good beer garden right nearby too. Let's go down to St. Louis now. Let's talk to our pal Katie Wu of The Athletic. Katie, good morning. How you doing?
Blake, Julia, how are you guys? Really nice to hear from you.
Excellent over here. Gotta ask, before we get into the relevant Cardinals Jays stuff, how do we feel about Clayton Kershaw whining a little bit? For anyone who didn't see it, so Clayton Kershaw's pitching at St. Louis on the weekend, and the Cardinals put up a video of Matt Adams in 2014 taking Clayton Kershaw deep in a very big playoff moment. Clayton Kershaw was not happy about it afterward. Katie, what was your take on the Cardinals doing that and Clayton Kershaw being maybe a little too sensitive about it?
So I wasn't there to hear Kershaw say it. I was in the Cardinals clubhouse at the time. But when I saw the video being played, I knew he'd notice. And I think this happens really at any kind of ballpark when you have a moment like that. I think it's probably a little bit more sensitive to Clayton because he is clearly a Hall of Fame pitcher with some sort of a postseason performance narrative, right? So you're always sensitive about that kind of stuff. But I hate to say it, Kershaw did get the last laugh. Five shutout innings, his best start since coming off those knee and toe surgery. And Cardinals lost 7-3. So good moment in 2014, but Clayton Kershaw and the Dodgers got the best of them yesterday.
Yeah, maybe it fired him up a little bit there, Katie, because he did come out looking a little bit like vintage Clayton Kershaw here. But otherwise, good series for the Cardinals. They took two out of three there, kind of to get back on track. This team is so interesting to me, Katie, because it always seems like they go in with high expectations and then they just spend the whole season kind of hovering around 500. But good start here. Maybe they cooled off a little bit. What have you seen from this iteration of the Cardinals?
Yeah, it's completely different because you're right. Usually in most seasons, the Cardinals come into the year with high expectations. And this year, the organization publicly said, maybe not. they had a transition year, right? That's what they termed this. They didn't want to call it a full rebuild, but President of Baseball Operations John Mozeliak is stepping down after the season. Chaim Bloom is taking over. Obviously, Toronto fans are familiar from that name in the AL East. This year was designated to just give the Cardinals young players as many opportunities to play every day, so they knew what the next core of this team would look like. So the expectations were much lower than usual Cardinals teams. Now, what that's led to, a very pleasantly surprising season so far for St. Louis. They're 7 games over .500. They beat the Dodgers in the series. They beat the Phillies twice. They beat the Mets. They keep beating good teams in the National League. They're kind of a surprise. So as the Cardinals continue to rely on their young pitchers and their young players, they've also been anchored by some veterans that stayed because of their no-trade clauses, Nolan Arenado, Wilson Contreras, Sonny Gray. And it's just kind of made this, I don't know, a hot pot, really, a melting pot of talent. And they've all really clicked. So it's a much better club than I think most of us, including myself, expected them to be.
Katie, for The Athletic, you wrote after one of the victories against the Dodgers, how this team has gotten it done, or at least did against the Dodgers, with a bit of small ball. And not just small ball, but executing in the right spots. That included Nolan Arenado pinch hitting on what was supposed to be an off day. When I look at the overall where the Cardinals are, not a ton of power, but pretty high average. Is the identity kind of become, at least on the offensive side, that they are a team that does those little things, the execution things, well enough to make up for what maybe isn't the highest end talent?
I think so. The Cardinals, to your point, do a nice job of getting on base. They have a high team average. They hit a lot of doubles. So while they're not leaving the park very frequently, they are still slugging in different ways. But again, they are so good at creating their own offense when they're not getting much. And they've done a really nice job against some of the higher end pitchers. And I think that's because of the way the lineup is structured. You have different players playing to their strengths. When you have guys that are speedy, like Mason Winn and Victor Scott II, you can lay the bunt down and you can steal bases. So that's what those two are good at doing. Lars Nootbaar and Alex Burleson, they work their walks. They work their plate approach so they get on base. And then you have a heart of the order with Brendan Donovan, who's just been tearing up the National League. I think he has the most doubles in the league, followed by Wilson Contreras, and Yvonne Herrera has been a surprising development. He was always kind of profiled as a bat-first catcher, but I don't think anyone saw the bat being this legit this early on in his career. Nolan Arenado kind of struggling through, slumping through some things, but his swing looks a lot better over the last week or so. So they have a little bit of everything in their offense, which makes them dangerous because they can beat teams in different ways, and that's kind of what they've been doing.
We'll ask you about some of these other guys. We definitely have notes in here about Yvonne Herrera and Wilson Contreras looking like a natural at first base. But first, I did want to ask you a little bit more in depth about Nolan Arenado, just because it started off as such a weird season for him. He ends up moving down the lineup, which apparently was his idea. It's been a weird progression so far, Katie, but he is starting to look a bit more like the Nolan Arenado of old, maybe?
I think so, especially defensively. Defensively, he's having a standout, stellar season at third base, and you're reminded why he won 10 straight Gold Gloves. I mean, he just looks completely rejuvenated over at third base. And a reminder that, you know, the Cardinals weren't really expecting him to be on the roster this year. They fully expected to trade him. We all remember that saga, how exhausting that offseason was. But he's here, and he's done a really nice job at committing to a situation that's probably not ideal for him and what he wants to do in his career. When you are a 34-year-old veteran whose major intentions known that you want to play in the postseason, your organization saying, okay, we're focusing on the kids this year, is probably not the messaging you want to hear. But he has done a really nice job along with Contreras and kind of letting those young guys in the clubhouse be themselves and offer that guidance when needed and when asked, and then going out there and perform to a major league level. So obviously the offense is not there. He's talked about it extensively, not happy with his swing, not happy with his performance, happy about his defense, but he's been working really hard with new hitting coach Brant Brown to figure out a way to get back to his pull side power ways. It looks a little bit better as of late, so hopefully he can just keep trending in the right direction.
So back to Herrera for a second here. So this is a team that has done such a good job with catchers that, okay, Wilson Contreras maybe didn't want him back there all that much anymore, but like Julia said, has really shone at first base. Yvonne Herrera is enough of a bat first catcher that he's DH'd the last five games because Pedro Páez is good behind the plate, and there's Yoel Pozo there. Katie, do you have an idea of like what has gone into the Cardinals doing such, and obviously this is the franchise that had Yadier Molina for a really long time, what's gone into them being able to develop catchers so well, or just ending up with four on the roster at a time when every other franchise basically is scrambling to find a second one?
You know, I actually think that's a testament to the roster construction, which was, you know, if you say, hey, we have four catchers on the roster and one's playing first base and one's the DH, you're probably thinking, what the heck kind of roster is that? Which is valid because I was too. But it's more of a compliment to Pedro Páez, who was never a top catching prospect. He came up and his preparation and his attention to detail, he won over the staff. He completely changes the game defensively. And that's allowed Herrera, who, again, a bat-first catcher and is still working on the defense, specifically the throwing, his bat plays. So there's no way that Ollie Marmol can take him out of the lineup. So those two alone, I think, are kind of the example of the Cardinals may not have a perfect development system. They're working on it. It's part of their big transition year with Heimblum taking over the minor leagues for now. But what they do have are they have players with really strong traits. And the Cardinals have done a nice job of highlighting those traits and using them to their advantage. If you morphed Pedro Pajes and Ivan Herrera into one catcher, you'd probably have the best catcher in baseball. But right now they found a way to kind of split them both up, have Pajes take over defensively. Herrera can bring the thump. And he's still getting some starts behind the plate when Herrera needs it. But also the separate part of this is by removing Wilson Contreras from behind the plate, not only were the Cardinals able to see what they had in Herrera and Pajes, but one, he's done a really nice job at first base. And two, it's freed him up to let his body feel better, and the offense is even more productive than years prior. So all around, while a questionable decision at the time, common theme with the Cardinals, it ended up working out, and I think it's probably the best way to utilize their roster right now.
It's nice to hear you say, Katie, that Wilson Contreras is actually doing a good job at first base, because you look at the numbers, the Savant page is really interesting because it's a lot of red on the fielding side, but obviously we're not following the Cardinals as closely, and so I'm like, you know, I had a little bit of my doubts there. Is this for real? So it's nice to hear you say that it is for real. And I'm wondering how he's taken, I guess, the move, right? That was a big story for the Cardinals in the preseason and spring training and all of that. What has that been like for him sort of through his eyes here?
Oh, he loves it. This is something that when John Mozeliak asked him over the offseason, Contreras, and I think the Cardinals were expecting some sort of pushback because they did sign Contreras to a 5-year contract to be their starting catcher. But Contreras said, if this is what's best for the team, I'll do it. I've done it before. And he's such a competitive guy. He actually said in that conversation, I'm going to win a gold glove there. And like, yes, everyone says that. But with Contreras, I mean, you can see that he really took this move personally and took it to heart to do a nice job. When you're coming in and filling in the defensive shoes of Paul Goldschmidt at first base, that's a tall order. But Contreras has been just as good as Goldie was there. I mean, he has saved the infield. The Cardinals' defense overall, it's the best in baseball. They come into play on Monday with a team 23 outs above average and the most defensive runs saved in baseball. When you have an infield with Nolan Arenado and Mason Winn on the left side, you know that you're going to have to, you know, the plays that they make, you have to do your part to make sure that play gets completed at first base. Contreras, he's done a heck of a job there, and he is well on his way, I think, to Gold Glove consideration if he keeps his pace up.
Yeah, it's got to be a nice thing for your pitchers to have that kind of team behind you from a DRS or outs above average perspective, especially if you're Andre Pallante, who is like the current king of ground balls. In fact, since he came into the league, the only pitcher getting ground balls more often is Brendan Little in the Blue Jays bullpen. So much, much smaller sample. But Pallante this year has been hit pretty hard. Katie, when you look at that, is that just a matter of because he is so ground ball oriented, there are going to be ups and downs in terms of you can string some singles and doubles together because he's not a big swing and miss guy? What have you made of him having not a terrible start, but a little bit of a shaky start compared to 2024 here?
Yeah, that certainly plays into it, and that's always going to be a risk when you have a predominantly ground ball pitcher, as you guys know, with your bullpen. But with Pallante, it's also a matter of him finding out a pitch that he can get right-handers out. He's really struggled against righties. He's always been kind of reverse splitty in his career where he's done better against lefties. So he's been trying to work in a more effective pitch mix against righties, and he's still experimenting with it, obviously, if you could tell by the last couple of results. He has not found the perfect combination yet, so he's trying to work with the sinker, with the four-seam, try to keep opposing right-handed batters off of his stuff so he can land the off-speed, and it's a work in progress, but that's kind of the whole point of the season with these young pitchers. Mm-hmm. Yes, the Cardinals are winning, and yes, probably, I would say, a contender at this point, but the main priority of the season remains extending runway to their young players. So while Pallante hasn't really had it his last few starts, the Cardinals are in no rush to replace him in the rotation. They're going to keep running him out there every 5-6 days until he makes the adjustments at the major leagues. That's kind of what makes the season fascinating, because they've been walking this line of runway for individuals versus results for the team. And I think manager Ollie Marmol's done a fantastic job in getting both. But in cases like Pallante, where you know he hasn't had it in 3 or 4 weeks, this start becomes a little bit more important, because it will raise the question, if Pallante does not perform well, what do they do next? Do they continue running him out there? Do they make a rotation change? I personally don't think that's in the cards for them just yet, but it is fascinating to think about.
How much more interesting does that get for you after Michael McGreevy comes up and has a spot start where, you know, not crazy numbers, but that's the toughest offense in baseball he faced in the Dodgers yesterday. I know you wrote about this for The Athletic as well, but does McGreevy looking solid kind of change maybe the timeline there to make a decision on Pallante or someone else in the rotation?
I get the sentiment, and most organizations probably, but the Cardinals outside of McGreevy have virtually no pitching depth. I mean, they just signed Zach Plesac to a minor league deal last week because they don't have any option outside of McGreevy and AAA to take a start. So that's why they have been so cognizant of using the schedule and using rest days for their rotation. Their pitching coach, Dusty Blake, had set out the schedule in spring training for the first 2 months to make sure every starter had at least one rest day each week, because the Cardinals have to preserve their pitching depth. So it's not like the Cardinals can switch out McGreevy and Pallante unless there's an injury, right? Because they need McGreevy to come in and take over in case anyone gets hurt, because they don't have anyone else outside of him. So it's a mess, much like the roster construction. It's fair to say, how are the Cardinals doing this? I ask that question probably twice a day. But with McGreevy, they need him as a depth piece for now, despite him being probably one of the top three arms in the rotation. That's just the way it is when you think about contracts and options and players like Miles Michaelis, Eric Fetty, who obviously the team can't and shouldn't option anyway. It just leaves McGreevy as the odd man out, coming in as the depth piece, as the spot starter, until, you know, hopefully this doesn't happen. But if there's an injury, then we'll see him in the rotation.
You mentioned Michaelis, and that was the name that I was going to touch on next precisely for that reason. It was a tough season for him last year, Katie, but he's been decent, right? I think that's the best adjective to use this time around. How valuable is it to have a veteran to somewhat anchor that rotation?
Yeah, he's been much better. Last year, and even 23, he was one of the worst pitchers in baseball in terms of ERA and hits surrendered. But Miles Michaelis, I think, took things a little personally. He lost for most of his career. He's been known as an innings eater, or a guy that can go out there and get you six quality innings, like maybe three runs, maybe two, maybe four, but enough to keep you in the ball game. And he had a really short hook to start the season. Ollie Marmol told him, like, hey, you have to build that trust back up with us. We're going to get you through five, but if there's a better matchup in our bullpen, you're coming out. And Miles said, I respect it. I hate it, but I respect that decision, and I'm going to work to get your trust back. And that's exactly what he did. He's had to reinvent his pitching style for so long. I mean, he's been in the league for a decade. He's gotten success by hammering first pitch strikes and getting weak contact. That method isn't always successful, especially in this modern version of the game where swing and miss is going to generate a lot more success for you. So he had to work on actually throwing less strikes this year. He's been all spring training talking about how he made his entire career being a strike thrower, and now the organization is telling him to miss the zone on purpose. And the reason to do that is because Michaelis is in the zone so much that opposing hitters could just time up the pitch they wanted. And we saw the exit velos. You saw how many hits he gave up, how many home runs he gave up. They were just teeing off on him. So by changing his entire repertoire and working more on getting swing and miss and being outside of the zone, he's seen a lot more success, and he's become one of the Cardinals' most durable starters.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is a guy who's thrown 200 innings three times in his career, which is pretty rare now. So if he can get back to that, immensely valuable for the Cardinals. We'll hope he doesn't tomorrow, but moving forward from there, maybe he'll be fine. Katie, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. We really appreciate it.
You guys are great. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Katie Wu of The Athletic. Yeah, we got Sam Shaw coming up. Otherwise, I would have asked her about why the Cardinals are trying to kill Kyle Leahy, their reliever who pitches every day and multiple innings. Phew. And in every situation. Tyler Holton has broken reliever usage in the league where it's just, whatever. Rubber. Every team's got one rubber arm guy, apparently.
Yeah.
Kyle Leahy, the big one for the Cardinals. The other interesting one, and we'll talk about this on Wednesday before that afternoon game, is Matthew Liberatore, yep, who had been one of the standout successes for the Cardinals in the early goings of the season, has had two rough starts in a row and left his last game with fatigue-related issues. Katie wrote at The Athletic that there's not really a concern about that. He got the extra time off because McGreevy was up to give them a six-man rotation the one time through. Not a lot of concern there at the team level, but it's certainly something I will have an eye on. Because
circle, for sure. Another relatively young guy, right?
In, yeah.
He's been around for a while, but he's still pretty young.
Yeah, and, you know, it's it's interesting, the fatigue related and the stuff dropped off a little bit in that game is, you know, those are some warning signs. Also a lefty, so it'll be interesting. We'll get a little mix. We'll get to see if Alan Rodon plays a game for the Blue Jays side. It'll be pretty straightforward until there, though. Okay. Down on the farm over the weekend, there was lots of good stuff. We talked about Max Scherzer's side. We talked about Adam Mako getting back at AAA. The single-A Dunedin Blue Jays also had a good week. They won They went 4-2 against St. Lucie. Obviously, six-game series when you're down at that level. They have gotten back above 500. It was actually a really productive week last week for all the teams. Even though there's been good individual stuff, none of the teams have been doing that well at the team level. But single A Dunedin and high A Vancouver both got back above 500, and then double A and triple A both had winning weekends as well. Of course, the standings reset at the midway point, and that's what determines the playoffs. So you're probably fine anyway. But nice to see Dunedin cooking. Nice to see Sam Shaw have another couple two-hit games. We talked about him with Doug Fox last week and how well-liked he is in the organization, how good he's looked at single-A Dunedin, and if a bump to Vancouver for the Victoria kid might be in the future. Let's take a break.
Yes.
Let's talk to Sam Shaw himself. Let's
Looking
talk about
it.
What it was like to get to play with Joey Votto last year. Nice. If you're a Canadian kid, I can't imagine what that was like. So we'll talk to him about it. Talk to him about getting coached by Ashley Stevenson. It's a good couple years for Sam Shaw,
absolutely.
And now the results are very much coming as well. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Sam on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Jays back in action at 7:45 tonight in the Lou in St. Louis. Jose Berríos against Andre Pallante. We'll set you up with that matchup in just a little bit here. Good stuff from Katie Wu of The Athletic in that last segment, giving us kind of the lay of the land. Interesting spot talking Red Sox where they're 500-ish and everyone's like, should we be rebuilding or should we be better?
Yep.
And then talking to Katie about the Cardinals where they're like, we kind of expected to rebuild and we're accidentally a little better than we thought. So now what do we do?
It's like, the Heim Bloom revenge tour.
The Red Sox are kind of in this nowhere middle ground because maybe they're not good enough to go all in, but they're not bad enough to fully rebuild and their fan base will reject it. Whereas the Cardinals are like, are we too good to be sellers now? And none of the guys we'd sell will accept the trade anyway because we gave out no trade clauses like the Raptors give out player options a couple years back. Anyway, that'll be a fun series. Jose Berríos against Andre Pallante tonight. Chris Bassett, Miles Michaelis on Tuesday. And then a big old TBD against Matthew Liberatore on Wednesday afternoon, a 2:15 start. Mentioned before the break, fun weekend around the minor leagues.
Absolutely.
Guys progressing in their injury recoveries, a couple big offensive lines, lots of wins. And that included a 4-2 week for the single-A Dunedin Blue Jays. Sam Shaw was a big part of that. He had a pair of two-hit games Saturday and Sunday. He joins us now. Sam, good morning, man. Thanks for doing this. How you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Good. Man, I guess let's start with just how are things going in Dunedin? I know you guys have heated up a little bit over the last week or two here.
Yeah, we have a really good squad here. Coaching staff is doing a great job. So vibes are high and, just enjoying it.
Nice. So obviously one of the challenging things about the minor leagues is you guys could get good as a team and then you might have your guys promoted. So you guys obviously had a couple of those and those guys are killing it in AAA now. Trey Savage, Gage Staniford, Cal Steven. What was that like for you guys as a team? Like obviously it's a win for you guys that those guys get promoted, but then you lose three pretty nasty pitchers.
Yeah. It's great to see those guys get called up. Love those guys. I've known Gage for a long time and it's great to see him doing well. But yeah, it's like if the Blue Jays lost their best three pitchers, like it would be tough, but I think we're getting back on track and, the arms threw great this week. And, but yeah, it was definitely a new experience for me, seeing that, but I think we're trending in the right direction. And I think, it's great to see those guys doing well in Vancouver. So, yeah.
Sam, we'll talk about your game a little bit more in a bit. But before that, I did want to ask you about getting drafted by, obviously, you know, the one team in Canada. That was back in 2023. Ninth round, the Blue Jays go above slot to sign you. Can you, I guess, walk us through the moment of being drafted, the decision of joining the Blue Jays? What was that like for you?
Well, I was talking with my friends the other day about it. I just had a feeling I was going to get drafted by the Blue Jays, just manifesting it, whatever it was, I had a feeling. But yeah, I was expected, like I got told I was going to go earlier. So to be honest, I wasn't even watching the draft. I went golfing with my friend and I got the call on the golf course, and I was just pretty excited. My phone started blowing up before I even knew. And it was just a cool experience, and to be able to play for my team, it's an honor, and yeah, I'm enjoying it.
Had you given any consideration to the college route at all, or like once it's the Blue Jays, you're like, this is too meant to be, forget, it's an easy decision from there?
Yeah, that definitely made my decision easier, or harder. but yeah, it was a dream come true, and just continuing to live the dream.
So you grew up a Blue Jays fan. I know there's the photo of you with the Alomars at one point and things like that. What is, like, can you tell us a little bit about what your Blue Jays fandom was like, or kind of your first Jays memories? You're still a young guy, obviously, so I imagine yours are a little more recent than mine.
Yeah. Well, like growing up, you had some not great teams there in like the 2010s. And then obviously, you got the Edwin Homer, the Batista bat flip. But I remember like my dad would sit me down and I would watch all the World Series games. So it was a long time ago, but I watched all those and watched the documentaries and everything. But yeah, growing up, just I remember I'm on the West Coast, right? So like the games would be right after school. So it'd be me and my friend Ben. I remember watching the Batista bat flip. I know exactly where I was, and we were both going crazy. We were with a big group of friends, and it was just him and I watching the game. Everybody else was playing outside, and we were just watching the game. But I think I'm fortunate to have such a good experience watching those earlier teams. And then now we got a really good squad this year, so I'm excited to – I'm still a fan, so be able to watch those games.
And then now, I guess here you are, right? And you're also representing Canada within the Blue Jays organization. We saw one of the tweets there that kind of laid out all of the Canadians in the Blue Jays system. And I'm wondering what that feels like, if you feel a sense of responsibility. How does it feel to, I guess, represent Canada within the Blue Jays organization?
Yeah. Well, first off, I'm fortunate for all the other guys that are here. Like Damiano Palmigiani kind of put me under his wing, helped me out a lot, but there's just a lot of really good Canadians in the system. So it's I think I have a lot of people to look up to and guys to help me out. So that's great. And then, yeah, there is a sense of pride and, you know, this is the team I played for, or I wanted to play for growing up. Team I love to watch, and now to be able to represent them is great. And representing Canada, I didn't have the best luck with the junior national team, but that was a great experience, and I'm very fortunate for that as well. And yeah, it's been great.
Speaking of Canadians in the organization, this didn't end the way that any of us wanted it to, but you briefly overlapped with Joey Votto last year in the Jays system as he was trying to get back from that ankle injury. What was that experience like for you? Did you get to pick his brain on hitting or just baseball in general?
Yeah, to be honest, I stayed out of his way. I wanted to see him in the big leagues, and I think I said that to him. It's like, I'm excited to see you play there, but I was so nervous to meet him. That might be the only guy I've been nervous to meet. I think like the first time I talked to him, I was stuttering quite a bit. yeah, it was great. And I hit like 1,000 when I played with him. So not good hits, but I got like a couple of dinky singles and stuff. But yeah, it was kind of just a unreal experience. He was one of my favorite players growing up. My dad's favorite player. So I'm going to have to get, we got a Joey Votto bobblehead night down in Dunedin. So I'm going to have to get one of those. And it was just, yeah, it was a crazy experience. And I was very fortunate to watch him play there. And I got a few tidbits to him, and he's helped me out a bit. So, it was cool. It's tough to explain. You don't want to not be a professional, but at the same time, you're like, wow, this is really cool that this guy's here, and I get to play with somebody I grew up watching and grew up idolizing, and he's hitting right behind me in the four spot. So it was pretty cool.
Dude, you want to talk about not being professional? I was going to ask you to sneak one of those Joey Votto bobbleheads off to the side. I know that they're only giving away 1,000 of them. It's not like here where there's like 15,000. Man, so you're obviously, it comes through, you're still a big Blue Jays fan. You mentioned you're still kind of cheering for the team now. What is that like day to day? Like, I know you guys play a few more afternoon games in Dunedin. Are you able to kind of keep up with the Major League Blue Jays at a fan level still?
Like, I can't watch every game. Obviously, mm-hmm. we're playing around the same time, but we have the TVs on in the clubhouse and stuff, and I watch the highlights when I can and do that. But I'll watch the game today. I got an off day today, so I'll watch the game. But just watching it when I can and kind of just keeping up to date, seeing the box scores and stuff. But team looks like they're doing very well. And a lot of guys, it's cool for me, like guys that I got to talk a lot with Alan Roden, really nice guy. And that was really cool. And I hit a lot with Barger to see him doing what he's doing. It's awesome. It's just very cool. And I'm proud of those guys, and just continue to watch them progress is great.
And to see them, I guess, progress as you also progress and change levels and move up here, Sam, I'm sure that it's encouraging for you to see your own development as well. And I am just wondering what the transition has been like for you from rookie ball to now being with the single-A Dunedin Blue Jays.
Yeah. Rookie ball is a difficult level. I think Florida in general is a hard level. It's hot down here, humid. Rookie ball last year, every game's at noon, so it's hot. I was the only guy that spoke English, but still had fun. Got to make some friends, learn a bit of Spanish, and then now moving up, get to play in front of fans, which is a lot more fun. And yeah, it's good. It was a challenge last year, and I think baseball is going to be a challenge forever, but just continuing to have fun and improve and help my team win and do whatever I can. But yeah.
Improves a good word there. And I mentioned you had a couple two-hit games on the weekend, hitting almost 300 on the season. And when I ask around with scouts, and I mean, I can see it, but it's not like we can watch every Dunedin game. The thing that comes up most often, and you mentioned Barger and Roden, two pretty nice lefty swings there. People love the mechanics of your swing. What's gone into that? Like, how much is that natural versus something you've been, you know, trying to tweak and professionalize over the last couple of years? Like, how have you kind of come to where you are with the mechanics of your swing?
I think if you talk to my dad, you could see some of the old videos that I had. I had a pretty good swing, but definitely refined it with here's a homer here, huh? definitely refined it a bit with my hitting coach Mitch Davidoff, and this isn't a great swing, so this isn't, yeah, that one's not as good, but got the job done. But yeah, my hitting coach back home, Mitch Davidoff, and then this offseason I spent some time in Driveline just cleaning some things up, and I think that helped me just hit the ball more flush and in the air to the pool side. And you know, it's a work in progress, and I'm just going to continue to clean it up. I think biggest thing for me is just being on time, and then everything kind of takes care of itself. But yeah, the baseball's a hard game where you have all these, it's like whack-a-mole of problems, right? It's like your swing's great, but something else. So just trying to simplify and make it as easy as possible, I think it's the best way to be successful.
I think it's telling that, you know, one of those swings there, you're like, oh, this is a bad swing, and then it's a single right in the gap, like perfectly placed. Yeah. And I mentioned that because one of the other things that stands out, and again, sometimes we're left to scout the stat line, not necessarily catch every Dunedin game, but big walk rate, and you strike out a little bit, but you have the lowest whiff rate of anyone in the Blue Jays system right now. And I don't know, maybe that's not something you want to pat yourself on the back about, but I am curious what your mentality is where the walk rate's high. You're obviously okay going a little deeper into a count and not swinging and missing. What goes into that? Kind of that balance between, you know, being aggressive but being cool to kind of sit back and, hey, if I strike out, I strike out, because you're so set on, you know, what you can do damage on and your ability to take a walk.
Yeah, I think recently I've been striking out a little bit less, just putting the ball in play with two strikes. But I think you can get into swing mode with two strikes, and a lot of the time you see guys chase. And if I want to have that high walk rate and get on base at a high clip, I got to be able to be okay with taking that borderline pitch. And sometimes the pitcher makes a perfect pitch and you get rung up on it. And I think I had the Phillies week. I got like three strikeouts where the catcher challenged it and it was like a half an inch on the plate. So it's like, yeah, I'll continue to improve that. It's something that our hitting coaches down here have helped me out with. But I think, yeah, you got to be able to get on your pitch and do damage with that. And if you do want to walk, you're going to have to be okay with hitting with two strikes. And that's something I'm comfortable with. And I'll continue to improve that. And, yeah, we'll see what the future holds.
And then on the other side of the ball, Sam, you're primarily an outfielder, but you've been seeing most of your work at second base this season. I know you had an outfield start here over the weekend, but what has the move to second been like? Is this something that you had done before, and how do you feel out there in the infield?
I love the infield. Definitely, I had like 300 innings last year in the outfield, so they can throw me out there whenever. So I played shortstop and center in high school. And then coming to pro ball, defense is like a big thing they wanted me to work on. So just continuing to improve there, kind of be like, find a way to help my team win. Like, for example, on Sunday, we had one of our Canadian outfielders, really good player, Bryce Arnold, wasn't feeling well. So he got taken out of the lineup and they needed somebody to go play outfield. And I was supposed to play second base that day. They sent me out to left field, and I don't have a problem with that at all. So just having that versatility, helping, yeah, again, the stock answer, but helping your team win, it's true. Whatever I can do to be on the field and help the squad.
Yeah, stock answers are stock answers for a reason. Right? Because they come up fairly often. Okay, I don't want to get too far ahead of things. You're still pretty young for the single-A level. But it has crossed my mind that you're having a really good start this season, and the next level up would be Vancouver, which is only a couple hours drive from your family. You've mentioned your dad a couple times in this conversation. Is he kind of like looking at the Canadian schedule and like asking you when it might happen? How excited is he for when that time comes?
I don't know if he's even mentioned it. My mom's mentioned it to me. I think they were both manifesting it, but I think Vancouver will be. I'm not going to get ahead of myself. The staff here is great. So whatever happens here, I feel like I'm in a great spot. But I grew up going to Canadiens games. It's actually a boat ride. It's a ferry, BC ferry, and a driveway from my house. But, yeah, I grew up going to those games. I have, like, a little ice cream, Vancouver Canadiens ice cream helmet in my room back home. So. Yeah, it'll be a very cool experience. I've heard great things about the Vancouver affiliate, it would be a lot of fun. But not gonna get ahead of myself and keep going. But it would be great to see my family and friends and my dog and everything. So
Well, we're rooting for you that'll Absolutely. Happen. And from my time in Vancouver, nothing beats an afternoon at the Nat. So hopefully you get to do that and your family gets to do that sooner than later. Sam, this was great, man. Really great to meet you. Really great chatting. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. All the best. Have a good one.
Thanks, man. Sam Shaw of the Dunedin Blue Jays, and probably by the end of the year for the Vancouver Canadiens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always forget Victoria's a ferry. I only went to Victoria once when I lived in Vancouver, but I should be as... Given that on the other coast, you have to take a ferry to get where I'm going.
Right.
Off the coast of Newfoundland, I should have a little bit of
It's okay.
Also, BC is just going to be mad at me lately. Someone messaged me and didn't like my comment that Ryan Dempster's hometown is no Abbotsford the other week. I'm just making BC enemies, BC enemies left and right.
Well, we all know that you're just joking, except for the geography part. But that's just because you're bad at geography.
Yeah,
it's not really your fault.
You can only have so many subjects you're really good at in school, and
gym was your one, and that was
I guess. No, math nerd too.
Don't, oh, really?
Drama nerd also. Yeah, just all the nerds.
Oh yeah,
all the nerds. What?
You're right. You were a math nerd and a drama nerd.
Yeah,
which...
that's why I know things like Andre Pallante's ground ball rate and the average height of his fastball and things like that.
Just fascinating.
I guess physics would have been the better path if I wanted to be like Alan Roden level talking about baseball. Anyway, we got a game tonight. It is Andre Pallante against Jose Berríos. Oh, actually, I had one note left over from the weekend stuff.
Yep.
I know this has been a pet question of yours, and it's popped up in the doc a couple of times.
Oh.
How is Tyler Heineman still doing this?
I know. It's unbelievable. And I, for a long time, just thought that he was lucky. And then you have a game like he put together on Saturday, and it's like, you're literally doing everything. It was good defense. It was, you know, timely timeouts at the plate to give Kevin Gausman a chance to rest a little bit more. And then he hits a home run. And then he is on the ump's face, not letting Kevin Gausman get ejected. And I'm like, well, you know what? That this is one that I have to put my hand on my heart and say, I was wrong.
Yeah,
I was wrong. I was chalking it up to luck. There's definitely, clearly more to it than that. He just keeps delivering. It's really amazing. Now, I'm not going to say that he should catch more. I'm not going to say that they should give Alejandro Kirk more time off, at least for now. But what a luxury it is, right, to have Tyler Heineman in the way that he's been doing things as your backup catcher.
Yeah, not sure the 1,000 OPS will stick around. He is hitting 500 on balls in play, which is, you know, league average is around like 290, and he's not a speedster, so that might come down. But there's an interesting thing here in that the better he plays, especially while Santander and Varsho are down, is that it gives you a little more freedom. We saw Alejandro Kirk DH the other day, which they hadn't really been doing because his off day needed to be his off day. But if you can suddenly look and say, well, Heineman could play 3 of the next 7 instead of 2 of the next 7. Even that little bit of extra comfort level. And then the underlying defensive metrics like Tyler Heineman just as much as they like Alejandro Kirk. So that's been really cool to see. That's a pretty good defensive tandem the Blue Jays have there.
We'll see. They may need more of Tyler Heineman in the second half, right? So we're still kind of waiting to see what this workload looks like for Alejandro Kirk. What it does to his offensive numbers, we can't be sure right now. And it's at least encouraging to have your backup be as productive as Tyler Heineman has been. He's a veteran, which is weird because he hasn't had a ton of time in the majors.
He's a veteran by age, but not of it. Like Alejandro Kirk has like caught more in the major leagues than Tyler Heineman has, even though he's a little younger. So not a little younger, he's 7 years younger. It's an interesting contrast there. Speaking of catching depth, by the way, Ali Sanchez elected free agency on the weekend, but then immediately signed back to a minor league deal. Michael Stefanik, meanwhile, accepted his outright assignment to AAA Buffalo. So that depth remains. There was a little bit of concern that you DFA both those guys. Your next man up isn't as strong. Speaking of next man up, Will Robertson and Joey Loprofito, as hot as it gets at AAA, by the way. Okay, Andre Pallante.
A lot of fastballs.
Lot of ground balls. He throws his fastball lower on average than almost any other pitcher in baseball. He also has a sinker. 63.4% of the balls put in play against him are on the ground this year. 66% for his career. I mentioned it earlier. Only Brandon Little has a higher ground ball rate since Pallante came into the league in 2022. But he has a 4.91 ERA, and the underlings agree with that. He has been hit very hard. He doesn't miss a lot of bats. Katie mentioned his issues getting righties out.
Yes.
It's been so extreme that he's now leading with the slider. He throws a slider more than his fastball or sinker against righties.
That is pretty fast.
Looking for something that can get them out. Against lefties, he basically just throws the fastball and then he'll sprinkle in the slider and the knuckle curve there. It's a pretty interesting one. The Jays saw him back in 2023, the opening weekend series in St. Louis. They saw him twice out of the bullpen, but that's it. Springer went 2-for-3. Bo Bichette went 1-for-3 with a double. Alejandro Kirk went 0-for-3. So not a lot of sample there. Jose Berríos has seen the Cardinals a little bit. Wilson Contreras and Nolan Arenado have had some success against him. Nolan Gorman, Alec Burleson, and Mason Winn have not. Berríos, of course, comes in 3.67 ERA, coming off of two very good starts in a row. We'll see if he can kind of keep that rolling here. Still not missing a ton of bats, but the pitchability is obviously at such a high level with Jose Berríos. And yeah, really since that first inning against the Rays 3 starts ago, he's been pretty much, I think it's 17 innings of one run ball since that bad first inning. And that's an arbitrary endpoint, but nice to see him. Nice to see him figure that out a little bit here. It should be a fun one. This is also a Cardinals team, by the way. Their bullpen doesn't miss any bats, and the Jays strike out less than any team in baseball. So could be a lot of balls in play. Katie mentioned they're the number one defense. The Blue Jays are very good defense as well. So hope you like defense.
Yeah.
That's basically it.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks to Katie Wu, by the way, for joining us. Thanks to June Lee. Thanks to Sam Shaw. Thank you to Amit Mon, Jake Schultz, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Blair and Barker have you 4 to 6 and postgame. I'll be on Blue Jay Central if you want a little bit more of me. We'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it all down. Have a wonderful Monday.